Welcome. Welcome to the Politics of Patients' Rights, Historical Perspectives and Contemporary Debates. I'm James Colgrove. I'm with the Center for the History and Ethics of Public Health at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, and I'm very excited to be moderating this panel of outstanding researchers whose work really exemplifies the ways in which an understanding of history can inform current policymaking. We have a fascinating selection of talks on patients' rights, on pharmaceuticals in children, and on the politics of environmental regulation, and I'm sure it will be a fascinating panel. I'm going to introduce all three of the speakers at the beginning. They will each speak for about 20 minutes, and then we'll have 30 minutes at the end for Q&A. Nancy Toms is professor of history at Stony Brook University. She holds a BA from the University of Kentucky and a PhD in history from the University of Pennsylvania. She is the author of three books, A Generous Confidence, Thomas Story Kirkbride and the Art of Asylum Keeping, Madness in America, Cultural and Medical Perceptions of Mental Illness Before 1914, co-authored with Lynn Gamwell, and The Gospel of Germs, Men, Women, and the Microbe in American Life. She is co-editor with Leslie Reagan and Paula Treichler of Medicine's Moving Pictures, and with Beatrix Hoffman, Rachel Grob, and Mark Schlesinger, Patients as Policy Actors, which is brand new from Rutgers. She's currently working on a book titled Shopping for Health, Medicine, Consumer Culture, and the Modern Patient. The title of her presentation today is Back to the 1970s, Reflections on the 1970s Consumer Health Revolution. Cynthia Connolly is associate professor at University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. She is a pediatric nurse practitioner and historian whose research focuses on the history of children's health care. Her research analyzes the forces that have shaped children's health care delivery and family policy in the United States. Her book, Saving Sickly Children, The Tuberculosis Preventorium in American Life, 1909 to 1970, was published by Rutgers University Press in 2008. Her current Robert Wood Johnson Foundation-funded project, A Prescription for Healthy Childhood, A History of Children and Pharmaceuticals in the United States, addresses policy debates surrounding pharmaceuticals for children since World War II. The title of her presentation today is Not at Present Indicated for Use in Pediatric Patients, Pediatric Pharmaceutical Policy in the United States, 1933 to 1979. Sarah Vogel is a program officer at the Johnson Family Foundation in New York City. Prior to joining the Johnson Family Foundation, she was the John C. Haas Fellow at the Chemical Heritage Foundation. She serves as co-chair of the Catalysts Working Group on Chemical Policy and Green Chemistry of the Health and Environmental Funders Network. She received a PhD from Columbia University and wrote her dissertation on the history of the political and scientific debates about bisphenol A. She also holds graduate degrees in public health and environmental management from Yale University and a bachelor's degree from the University of Virginia. The title of her presentation today is Of Baby Bottles and Bisphenol A, Mommy Bloggers, Consumer Activism, and Market Campaigns in Environmental Health. So I will now turn the floor over to our first speaker, Nancy Toms.
Thank you. As James told you, my presentation today is drawn from a book that is hopefully nearing completion that explores the historical genesis of a particular kind of patient empowerment that takes the form of critical consumerism. And what I mean by that term, consumerism, is the movement seeking, this is a definition from the American Heritage Dictionary, the movement seeking to protect and inform consumers by requiring such practices as honest packaging and advertising, product guarantees, and improved safety standards. I say critical to differentiate it clearly from other common meanings of the term consumerism that may signify, for example, a belief that a progressively greater consumption of goods is economically desirable, or to describe a deep attachment to materialistic values or possessions. These are other common definitions of the term consumerism. In health terms, this critical consumerism in the United States has been characterized by a cluster of practices now considered essential for getting good care. Reading labels, decoding advertisements, asking questions of one's physician, keeping abreast of the latest scientific developments, trolling for the latest and best information on the internet, and last but not least, second-guessing all forms of scientific expertise and bureaucratic logic. The dominant version of this patient as consumer is what my shorthand for it is, the shopping model. It is a given that in the United States, Americans are only going to get the best care by shopping for it with great skill and determination. And I'm curious, why do we have this notion that the only way you can get good care is by having to work so hard to find it? Now, while this shopping model is very popular in the mass media, and alas, even in some health policy circles, it is in fact a problematic model in many ways. Sorry, I'm not very good at 20-minute oh, thank you so much, yes. I'm not very good at giving a short version of this, probably because it's not very clear in my own head yet. But let me give you a couple of sort of my basic assumptions, and then I'm going to move on to a more specific discussion of the 1970s. My challenge as a historian is to present what I see as both the strengths and the weaknesses of critical consumerism as an approach to patient empowerment, and clearly I think it has both. I hope in particular to help physicians and patients understand where this shopping model came from historically. And I have to say, for physicians, this explanation is a particularly uphill climb. While today's American physician has sort of gotten used to the idea of an empowered patient, the idea of the patient consumer is still deeply repugnant. They regard it as a terrible idea thrust on them by managed care advocates in the 1980s. But in fact, as I argue throughout my book, the shopping model has much longer historical roots, and in large part it was provoked by the professionalizing behavior of the American Medical Association. So they have been hoist on their own petard in my respect. So I am taking a critical point of view. I see many ways in which the rise of consumer reflects a narrowing of patient choices and not a grand celebration. I'm just showing you a couple of the next one. Yes, I'm well aware that this terminology is a complex and a vexed one, that the overlap between the model of the patient and the model of the consumer is an uneasy one. This is just a summary slide I've developed of the different kinds of meanings that the two terms have in different contexts. But the historical trend has definitely been to a greater overlap, and the use of the term consumer has become especially dominant in discussions of the economic aspects of medical care. Now, contrary to what most people expect when they hear about what I'm talking about, my book ends in the 1980s. I do have an epilogue, but I basically see the 1980s as the end of my story and not the beginning. In fact, the first use of the term consumer for patient that I've been able to find in the United States dates from the 1920s, as the discipline of medical economics began to look at the economics of healthcare. I expected to find it earlier in progressive era debates around the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Acts, but in fact, while the concept is certainly there, the terminology was not. There was not discussion of consumers, but rather of the public, protecting the public. So that was the term in use then. So it's only in the 1920s that I found that this linguistic equation of patients and consumers first emerged, primarily among academics and lay reformers, and in the public health circles certainly, who were attempting to articulate problems they saw in the restructuring of the medical marketplace that had taken place during the progressive era. And simply put, this restructuring created expectations that both doctors and drugs were better and safer. And when those expectations were repeatedly unmet or disappointed, interwar commentators started to use the language of modern consumerism to articulate what was wrong with the new system of protections offered through things like drug labeling and medical licensing. So in my book, I start with the 1920s. I end with the 1980s with an epilogue to the present. I'm going to focus in my talk today primarily about my struggles with the 1970s, and I'm hoping maybe there's some actual people in the audience who were there who can enlighten me. I want to start by saying that looking at the 1970s consumer movement, health consumer movement, the intersection of a more radical consumer movement associated with Ralph Nader that intersects with a civil rights, human rights movement comes together in the 1970s and makes for an extremely important period of discussion and change. And it's this cross-fertilization, I argue, of a civil rights, human rights perspective and a more old-fashioned kind of consumerism that turns out to be a powerful force for change. Next slide. It's important, and as in trying to be understand the limits of the consumer model as it was developed in the mid 1970s, to recognize that it was building on older traditions. I'm sorry, I've already talked through that slide. Also, not very good at keeping my eye on my. Yeah, go to the next one. Again, I try to have a balanced perspective. There were some extraordinary achievements that came through this alliance between the consumer movement and the patients' rights movements of the 1970s. And certainly want to acknowledge that and to see the glass as half full rather than half empty. But it was it is obvious going back and reading the discussions of in the 1970s that the limits of the consumer model were already being recognized and discussed by the mid to late 1970s, and not from a conservative beginning of Reagan movement, but rather from the progressive left. And in the remainder of my talk today, I want to focus on what emerged then and remains one of the most obvious problems with the models of consumer empowerment and concepts of consumer sovereignty more generally. And that was the weaknesses of a market model in an era of expanding income inequality. In other words, what do you do with the phrase was the low-income consumer. Every time I read that now, it makes me think of how we're not allowed to call rich people rich. We have to refer to them as job creators. Well, the low-income consumer is basically the poor people. It was clear in much of the criticism of the late 60s and the 1970s was about income inequality, especially in its racialized versions. And the problem that a consumer empowerment model isn't going to work very well for very poor people was obvious even then. Not only do they have less income to spend, but as studies were showing, they often lived in areas where prices were higher for goods that were shoddier, and where business practices put them at a far greater disadvantage to their wealthier neighbors. And this indeed became a theme of discussion even in the early 1960s. We see, David Kaplowitz, you may have heard of this book. It's still a classic worth reading, Poor Pay More, which presented a compelling case of the structural disadvantages that poor Americans faced. It was based on a study of four neighborhoods in New York City doing interviews both with the consumers and the businesses that serve them. Kaplowitz, in this groundbreaking book, emphasized the problems that consumers faced as they were essentially preyed upon with unethical business arrangements, as well as the problems they faced because of what we now call shopping deserts, to use the First Lady's term, produced by white flight suburbs that left neighborhoods with very few stores yours to start with. As Kaplowitz put it, his was a study of, quote, people with little money, with little competence as consumers, and with little chance of avoiding exploitation in the marketplace. Consumers poor in three senses of the word. This lack of sophistication as shoppers made them vulnerable. And this was playing off an idea of an educated consumer as someone who gets information, makes wise choices of a kind that had become dominant among affluent Americans. Well, this lack of sophistication was putting them at risk. It was also a lack of trust in experts, of not knowing how to find information or an active distrust of experts as well that put them at a disadvantage. And I'll note just in passing that in 1968, the Kerner Commission cited the predatory sales and credit practices as one of the most deeply felt grievances that were expressed in the urban riots in the late 1960s. Now, these early discussions focused on consumer durables like furniture and appliances and banking practices, check cashing, credit, charges. Healthcare transactions soon became part of this critical review as well. But here the impetus largely came out of the welfare rights movement. An offshoot of the larger civil rights struggle of the 1960s that addressed the problems surrounding welfare programs, including the recently introduced Medicaid system. That was highlighting the tensions between modern medical practices and the poor non-white subjects that they were encountering in many large urban hospitals. And starting in the mid-1960s, these concerns began to be addressed by the National Welfare Rights Organization, shown here marching. And it's this organization you're probably familiar, pressured the American Hospital Association to produce the first Patients' Bill of Rights. And Beatrix Hoffman has written a very nice article about that. We can see leaders, whoops.
Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. No, we're ready. We're ready. Yes, okay, right. Yes. The early leaders, George Wiley and Johnny Tillman of the National Welfare Rights Organization. And the problems of the low-income consumer also attracted the attention of the kind of appointees who were ending up in federal government positions in the 1960s and 1970s. And in the next, we see two very different faces, two people who had showed a particular interest in the problems of the low-income consumer, not so much in health terms, but generally also in the 1960s. Person on the left is Mary Gardner Jones. In 1964, she became the first woman appointed to the Federal Trade Commission. And while there, she helped campaign for the Fair Packaging and Labeling Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the Truth in Lending Act, all of which passed before she left the commission in 1973. And she was known for her particular passion about the problems that the marketplace created for poor Americans. On the right is Esther Peterson, a labor organizer, AFL CIO for many years, who served in both the Johnson and Carter administration as Special Assistant for Consumer Affairs and was also a passionate supporter of consumer reform as an essential requisite for social justice in the 1970s. So the convergence of government regulatory drawing its roots from the consumer movement going back to the 1920s with this more civil rights, human rights oriented campaigns of the 1960s made for an extremely powerful dynamic in the years roughly late 1960s through the mid-1970s. Next, and certainly one of the assumptions, I think, on all sides here is that consumer protection as a general ideal would lift all boats, so to speak, that there was a kind of universalism in consumer protection that meant that by addressing issues like credit, like patients' rights in hospital settings, that this was going to be advantage for both low-income and high-income consumers. But what has struck me in looking at the rhetoric of the time period and also the results is how much the alliance with the human rights angle actually were to ennoble and empower the problems of middle-class consumers that, it will come as no surprise to you, tended in the long run to dominate the discussion. In a 1970 editorial, Theodore Crone, who was the founder of an advocacy group called the American Patients Association in 1969, suggests both the energizing and the potentially divisive qualities of this broadly conceived health consumers movement. In the editorial, Crone explained that his group's first principle was that, quote, the patient's lot must not be determined by his income, religion, neighborhood, or race. When his group said, quote, we speak for the consumer, our audience usually expects us to be indigent, black, and angry ghetto dwellers. Some members of the American Patients Association, he said, did fit that description, but many did not. It came as a, quote, a shock to providers when they understand that many well-heeled white consumers have also had it up to here with the health establishment and want some changes made. Reformers had started with the goal of bringing better health service to our minority poor, but in the process they had discovered that the deprived consumer of health service was not only black and poor, but white and affluent as well. Health deprivation, these are his words, is now recognized among all of our people of every color and station. And if only we can one day provide excellent care with the same egalitarian spirit, we will have accomplished a great deal for the American model consumer. Well, this dynamic period, in fact, led to an approach that did not lift all boats. The critical consumerist approach tended to reinforce already a strong focus on specific products and procedures to make drugs safer, to get informed consent for the operation, rather than the structural sources of ill health or income disparities as barriers to care. Now, the problems inherent in this consumer approach were duly noted in the 1970s, and an early entrenching critique can be found and Louise Lander's 1978 book, Defective Medicine. To the extent that health consumer activism focused on improving patient choice of physician, product, and service, she said, it, quote, ratifies, even encourages some of the most invidious trends in modern medical practice, including the trend to increasingly commodify the process of giving and receiving medical care. Lander wrote, by bringing caveat emptor to the arena of medical practice, the consumerists, consciously or otherwise, are encouraging doctors to act just like entrepreneurs, unencumbered by any social obligation to exercise ethical restraints over what they do to patients. And by adapting the methods of choosing a refrigerator to selecting a physician, she concluded, the consumerist, individualistic, every man for himself economic model had brought them into alignment with conservative forces that wanted to bring more market discipline to medicine. Now, in many respects, I think Lander's critique was uncharitable in that she gave little acknowledgement to the awareness among health consumer activists that structural issues were important, that income inequality was important. But those kinds of structural changes, the emphasis on prevention as opposed to how to finance more acute care, were very difficult for them to bring about. And so the focus on making individual products and processes safer was a default observation. But I think her observation that the consumer overlay in the 1970s had essentially softened the ground for the more market-oriented approaches of the late 1970s was absolutely was a good insight. Though the weaknesses in the consumer model, its ability to be co-opted by a more market-oriented approach to medicine, were clear even well before Reagan's election in 1980. And in the last part of my book, I look at how the fire of the 1970s was domesticated in the 1980s with a growing emphasis on individual responsibility and increasingly redefining critical consumerism as an obligation that individuals have to try to make a dysfunctional healthcare system work more efficiently. But that responsibility being put on individuals, the equation of product advertising as a form of consumer information, which was behind the changes, for example, forcing me into the AMA's ban on physician advertising and also laying the foundation for more direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs because that was consumer information. And increasingly creating a policy menu in which failures to receive adequate care could be based on a lack of sophistication in one's shopping behaviors. Obviously, a kind of blame that could be more easily assigned to the low-income consumer than the more affluent. As income inequality has accelerated since the 1970s, as we're well aware, the problems of the poor fit between consumer-oriented model and the problems of poor Americans has only gotten worse rather than better. And indeed, much of what the public health field attempts to do today is to address, to analyze and address those problems as best they can. But I just want to conclude with a global perspective, something that surprised me, having worked on this topic in the 1970s when I was preparing for this talk. I decided just to random Googling of low-income consumer and see what I got, and I was surprised to find a marketing conference devoted to how you market better to low-income consumers, but guess where it was held? Bangkok. This is the new perversity. Forget low-income consumers in the United States. So let me show you this last slide. The conferences that are being held to try to help companies mostly learn how to do brand advertising more effectively in Asia, India and Asia, East Asia as well. So this concept of learning how to engage the low-income consumer has taken on a strange and perverse life outside the United States as we speak.